The old adage from Bill Clinton's campaign, "It's the economy, stupid," has never been more appropriate.
Well, if you look at what Mr. Trump is saying, he's saying those words. It's the economy, stupid.
This week, the race for the White House. And it's the economy, stupid. We look at the policies that could shape the next 4 years in the United States.
Welcome, dear listeners. And welcome back to Is the Economy Stupid? As always, I'm Damien, and I'm joined by my favorite presenter, it's Gianluca.
Ciao. Hello, guys.
Ciao, Gianluca. Come stai? Having left you, we only had one episode at the beginning of the season and then have left a bit. So just a reminder, it's very important for all of you to subscribe to the podcasting platform you're listening to us, be it Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or any other, so that you don't have to check our Instagram all the time to know when we are dropping up an episode. Usually we'll be publishing on Mondays every 2 weeks, so you can follow that schedule. But if we don't, just check on your podcasting platform and subscribe there. On Instagram, we're very active to promote our episodes as well, so if you just want to check that, that's fine too. Last time, Gianluca, we talked to Joe, right?
Yeah, right. That was
very interesting.
Insightful experience.
Yeah, Nobel Prize 2021 in economics. For the ones who haven't listened to that episode yet, it's definitely one of the best I want to know, I guess, right? Maybe your episode on GDP was at the same height, but otherwise...
I think mine was better, but
yeah, fair enough. Okay, but otherwise, for the other people, go listen to the episode on from Joan, our number 12. Definitely worth it. Lately, Gianluca, you and I, we were having some cold ones, right? Together, chilling by the pool.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, some cold brews, some brewski. Yeah. Cold brew, because you made coffee, right? You made this modern coffee. We're talking together. And we were talking about what this podcast kind of has been linked to a lot. So, but we avoided a subject mainly on this podcast. We avoided talking about the pandemic. Our guests always bring the pandemic up, but we try to not talk about it, right, on this podcast.
Yeah, it's a bit of an elephant in the room, let's say.
Yeah. But we couldn't avoid it this time, because last time we were talking about different medicines and mostly the vaccines that the pandemic has been linked to, that we all have been facing this time. And we're thinking, how is it possible that those pharmas develop all those vaccines without knowing if they're going to make any profit out of it, right? That's so weird. But then Gianluca, you said, I have no idea. I can't help you with that. And I didn't know either. So we decided to contact the guests. And today we're very happy to welcome our guest, Gabriele Hertig from the NGO Public Eye. Gabriele Hertig, welcome to Is the Economy Stupid?
Hello, thank you.
Maybe as a health expert, can you talk to us a bit what that actually implies, what you're working on, and why you are the person to talk to today about this episode?
Yes, I'm working for Public Eye, which is a Swiss NGO. So the NGO as a whole works on different subjects, always with the focus on the responsibility of Switzerland and Swiss companies. And I'm, together with my colleague, who's actually in Lausanne, Patrick Durisch, I'm responsible for health policy and access to medicines. So for us, this pandemic, COVID-19 and all the discussions around it, were really a bit a showcase of a perverted business model that we've been observing in the last years.
Fine introduction. So I want to ask a first question to you, if I may. So can you give us an explanation briefly on of how the current business model in pharma operates when companies develop a new drug or a vaccine?
Yes. So usually, and what is often not discussed so much in public, it's universities and other institutions that do the basic research, right? So it's years of basic research, often funded with public money. Then usually, as you must know also from other fields, it's startups that take up that innovation, they patent it, and then come the big pharmaceutical companies that do actually buy up those rights the rights for that innovation, or they buy up the whole startup. And what we've observed in the recent maybe 20 years is that these big pharmaceutical companies, or as we call them, big pharma, they more and more operate like private equity funds. So they are not so much active in the actual development and nitty-gritty of research and development. So they rather buy up the rights and other companies in a very speculative manner. So there are some commentators that compare this to like an FDA approval, for example, like the US drug regulating agency. An FDA approval is like striking oil, right? These big companies, they bet on the approval of a new medicine, which would actually then reward them.
So it's all about M&A in this time in the pharmacy industry. And acquire.
Exactly. And also, so after the big pharmaceutical companies come in, they of course have to do the clinical trials, phase 1, 2, 3, and we heard a lot about them also in the pandemic. It is those big companies that have the resources, the knowledge to do those trials, the expertise on all the paperwork and so on. So they are kind of actually in the system we have today, they are important actors, but they are also those that make the largest profits based on public funding and years of basic research in universities.
Could we say that the big pharma, like you call them, are in some sorts buying up the funding that the government has given to those small companies?
Yes, we could say that. And in our view, I mean, it's companies, they have their own profit logic. So in our view, it's the responsibility of states to intervene and to also put conditions, for example, on that public funding. So conditions could be for access, for price, and so on. But what we see currently is that the system we have allows pharmaceutical companies to kind of gaming the system because they have all those privileges, and we maybe talk a bit later about the IP and patent system. So they have all those privileges, but there are no states that actually make sure this is in the interest of the public and people everywhere.
That is very frightening, I would say, as a system. We are definitely, I guess, in what you've just explained to us, which is definitely news to me. I don't know about you, Jernica, but we can almost say that those multinationals are exploiting our public money, or exploiting the taxpayers' well-earned money for their own profit.
Yeah. And okay. Just to add, because you just said in the introduction about vaccines, so how do pharmaceutical companies know they can invest now in vaccines and this will be a good business? So usually vaccines are not a good business for pharmaceutical companies. So many companies, they sold their vaccine business. And only with the beginning of the pandemic, this suddenly became a super profitable business. And they had all the public money that not only in the basic research, but then also later on, in the early 2020, when states really additionally invested into the development and the fast development of vaccines and also to some degree of drugs. So it's estimated that alone in 2020, it's over 93 billion euros of public money. So in that sense, there is a lot of public money and investment there, and there should be some conditions attached to that.
That is absolutely fascinating to see how much money is involved in here. I cannot grasp it. I'm sure Jernica cannot either. But now that we've kind of set the stage for our questions, maybe let's go into a bit more detail. The NGO you work at, Public Eye, has in its latest report identified 10 ways to which big pharma that we just talked about cashes in its relation to COVID-19 drugs and vaccines. You've just mentioned, I guess, one of them, the main one, or maybe all of them. I'm not entirely sure, but can you maybe get a bit more into some details and give us some examples of the ways in which these big farmers are making that money and why these are legal?
Yes. So, for us, we published this report. It's almost a year ago, and it's called Big Pharma Takes It All. It was for us, as I said in the introduction, COVID-19 was kind of a showcase of a perverted business model. So these 10 strategies that we describe in this report, they are not new, but they also worked really well in this pandemic. And we observed this from the beginning of the pandemic with a lot of literature that we read, media reports, company statements, and so on. And it's also, we kind of wanted to observe a bit what happens to that promise in the beginning of pharmaceutical companies and states to actually work together to solve this crisis together, to allow equal access to treatments and prevention of the disease. And of course, as we see today and as we see with the profits of these companies, it's actually not what's happening. And as we see with the unequal access to vaccines, diagnostics, and drugs. So you said one of those strategies is, socializing risk, privatizing profits, as we call it. So we just discussed about that. Maybe another one that I would like to mention is that pharmaceutical companies determine R&D priorities by their profits. It's also a bit related to what I said about the vaccines. Usually that's not a profitable business. So what is profitable is chronic disease. It's disease of people in high income countries, and it's not the disease of people in low and middle income countries. So we see like a chronic, I use also chronic now, we see like underinvestment in those areas. So it's again the public and nonprofit organizations that step in and kind of fill this gap. And maybe another strategy that I can highlight and that maybe is related also to some of the disbelief about how those companies can actually game the system in such a way is the excessive lobbying. I mean, every industry lobbies, but the pharmaceutical industry is the industry with the largest investment in lobbying. We see this very, of course, these numbers, they are difficult to get, but renowned publications estimate that they have a really, really high investment in lobbying. And they kind of even managed to create a discourse in which we believe that intellectual property and pharma monopolies are necessary and essential for innovation, which maybe we can talk about why it's not.
Well, we are like describing all this pharma like they are the evil empire in Star Wars. Have you an idea of that? But I would like to take a little step back and talk about public money. So this is my question. One aspect that always surprises us, at least me, is the price that some vaccines or other drugs are sold at, considering that they were developed with the support of governments and other public institutions. So can you explain to us how companies are able to set their prices so high, in your opinion?
Yes, just to clarify on the evil empire, of course, there's no conspiracy there, just to be very clear, especially in this age. But of course, very big companies that have a lot of influence. And as I said, it should be actually states who are driving the car and not the companies. So your question about how is it possible that companies can set such high prices, just very briefly maybe on the patent system and intellectual property rights, which is kind of the reason why pharma have the monopolies they have and have the pricing power they actually have. So patents usually are there to kind of reward someone who invents something novel, non-obvious and useful. So with patents, pharmaceutical companies can then prevent others from making and selling an innovation or an invention. And this results, of course, in a monopoly position where they are the only ones having the right to sell that product on the market. This creates quite an imbalance, as you know, from monopolies when they negotiate prices or even just set prices at the level they want. Internationally, the intellectual property rights and patents, so patents are just one of several intellectual property rights, they are protected at the World Trade Organization through the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, the TRIPS agreement. And it's kind of remarkable that many countries did not know the protection of or did not know patents for drugs. So many countries like India or South Africa did not have that system in place until a harmonization under TRIPS. And they had their reasons for not allowing the patenting of drugs. But with the introduction of this international agreement, they were forced to grant patents. And this is where we are today, where we have companies that have the patents on those drugs, and they decide to whom they sell, at which price they sell, and so on.
Oh, I didn't know about the setup of the history of the TRIPS. That's very interesting. And actually, it leads us, thank you very much, it leads us immediately to the next question. Right now at the WTO, the World Trading Organization that you mentioned, that there's a discussion on signing the TRIPS waivers that are pushed by the two countries you just mentioned, India and South Africa. So I guess this is definitely a historical background. But can you maybe explain to us, what does that mean? What are TRIPS waivers? And why are some countries opposed to it?
Yes, so the TRIPS waiver would suspend this TRIPS agreement for a limited period of time, and in this case for COVID-19 technologies. So it would only be for diagnostics, drugs, and vaccines for COVID-19, and only for the duration of the pandemic. So it was India and South Africa that in October 2020 made this proposal for waiving intellectual property rights related to COVID-19 technologies. And they did so because they saw there is limited production capacity. It's only a few companies that could, did produce, and we can talk about that later, that did produce vaccines at that time. Now it's also drugs and so on, but that did produce the tests and the vaccines. And so there was this limited production capacity, and there were these high prices and the discretion of those companies to set the prices as high as they wanted. And this led to very unequal access, because even if there were some international mechanisms in place to supply vaccines and other technologies to low and middle income countries, it was rich countries who first made their orders, who paid higher prices. And of course, as the game goes, game is maybe a bit, we shouldn't call it game because it costs life. But it was then, of course, to those countries that the pharmaceutical companies first delivered and sold the vaccines, and not to, as it was initially, for example, thought by the WHO, to, let's say, 20% of the population in every country to protect the most vulnerable. So it was then that India and South Africa said, we need a decentralized production where every country can decide to suspend these intellectual property rights just for this period of time in this huge crisis. And there, that is possible within the TRIPS agreement, but there has to be a consensus among member states to actually implement the TRIPS waiver. But they made this proposal because they said we need companies in all those other countries to produce those vaccines. There are those companies, but they are not allowed currently to do so, and they can be sued if they would, because we have the IP rights that only allows certain companies like Pfizer or Moderna to produce those vaccines.
A question coming to my mind, so I was focused on that, I'm sorry. So as today I'm enjoying playing the part of the conspirator, I would like to ask another question of this kind. If the TRIPS waivers could help to diminish the spread of COVID, why would European countries seek to block them? Are the lobbies from Big Pharma really stronger than the will of the population to put an end to the pandemic?
Yes. It's the simple
really,
answer.
Really? That's not a good promising
answer. Let me explain that. So what I didn't mention before is that actually now over 100 countries, over 100 member states of the World Trade Organization support this TRIPS waiver, but there are still some strong opponents, and there needs to be a consensus decision. So the opponents are the EU, Switzerland, and the US is kind of in the middle. They say it's kind of legitimate, or they would kind of support waiving patents for vaccines, but not for other technologies, which is also a bit a difficult position, especially now as we see all those drugs coming to the market that can be helpful in actually treating COVID-19, and that should be accessible as well. So yes, it's the lobby of the pharmaceutical industry and their success also in promoting certain narratives. So for example, they say there would be no innovation anymore if we would just waive those intellectual property rights. And it's states that protect that business model. And it's also, of course, then other fears that are spread, like, you know, jobs would be lost if we waive intellectual property rights. But jobs are not tied to those huge profits that we currently see that those companies generate and then actually take for their CEOs or for their shareholders rather than the general employee. So yes, it's those lobbies that are very strong, and it's also ideologically in those countries that they see this business model as the only way.
That is frightening, but good that you still mentioned it. That's good that we learn even through pain. you touched on a few points. You touched late in your last few questions, you touched on the fact that the TRIPS waivers, the opposition to it is justified through the idea that they would lose all sense of patterns. But he also touched on a point that he said we might talk about it later, that I want to come back on, and the idea that the Global South cannot produce the vaccine. That's one of the opposition, notably by representatives from the European Trade Federation Association representatives. They pointed out that it doesn't matter, we don't need to have the TRIPS waivers, because in South Africa and India and all those other Global South countries, they don't even have the plans to produce the vaccine. Can you explain why this opinion is, in your opinion, wrong, and why it is still used by the Swiss representatives?
Yes, it's one of the arguments that we hear since the beginning of the pandemic. As you said, pharmaceutical companies and representatives of the government, like in Switzerland, argue that the other countries and other companies would not be able to produce safe and effective vaccines, drugs, and so on. This is wrong. There was, at the end of 2021, there was a study by Human Rights Watch that identified over 100 companies in different countries that would be able to produce mRNA vaccines. So there are those companies. I think a lot of, I mean, this is of course a motivated argument, right? You don't want to change the system. And there is also a very, in my view, a very colonial, or we could say post-colonial argument in that, that kind of presents some parts of the world as able to produce world-class technology and others as not. And of course, it's the so-called Global South that is not able to produce this first-class or world-class technology. This is one aspect. The other is, it's actually the responsibility of the drug regulating agency to make sure that treatments or vaccines are safe and effective. So in a way, it's not the responsibility of pharmaceutical companies. And we have, I mean, there is a problem perhaps with some drug regulating agencies that are not strict enough and so on, but this is another matter. So in a way, it's also an argument that doesn't hold, because it's not, it's the responsibility of the regulating agency to make sure these treatments and vaccines are safe and effective. And last but not least, I always find this amusing a bit, because if other companies wouldn't be able to actually produce those technologies, what's the fear about? So why are they so scared? Why do they put so much money in opposing the TRIPS waiver?
That does make does make a lot of sense. Yeah, it wouldn't be any use to oppose the TRIPS waiver if you're not afraid of losing your patent. That makes sense. You've just given us a very frightening and bleak view of this field. I've got to admit, to the point that which not even half through to our questions, Gianluca already called the pharma the Empire from Star Wars, which is not a good comparison.
I was joking, please.
but maybe you could finish on a nicer note, and give us a good view, a view of what we could potentially, or what could be potentially, maybe not by us, but by someone, what could be changed in the system so that Big Pharma maybe loses its, I would call it, type of monopoly power, and kind of gets back into a system where we all enjoy its benefits without having to suffer from it.
Yes, we often call this a broken social contract, right? So it's not that patents per se are bad, but it's currently the system we have is exploited. So it's kind of not in balance between incentive and public reward, or reward for the public. So in terms of possible solutions, there are some that are more radical, that are about open science, that are about delinking research and development from the enterprise. So you could, for example, reward an innovation through push and pull mechanisms, but then leave it at that without creating a monopoly for the duration of 20 years as we have it currently with the TRIPS agreement. So these are some of the more, I would say, maybe from my point of view, not so radical, but for others, very, very radical solutions that are also politically very difficult to push and to make progress on. And then there are other solutions within the current system where we could actually change things, and on which we are also working at Public Eye in relation to Switzerland and within our international networks, which are about transparency and accountability. So as I said before, you could tie conditions or conditionalities to public funding. You could ask pharmaceutical companies to publish, and you would have to monitor this in some way, their actual research and development costs, so that you could compare, or that you could find a kind of a fair price, which is also a big discussion, but you get the idea. And there are all, even within the TRIPS agreement, that is really not in favor of many, many people in low and middle income countries that don't have access to medicines, and increasingly also in rich countries like Switzerland, where the health system, or the costs of the health system, are really skyrocketing, and medicines make about 20% of those costs. So, I mean, it's a big part. So there are flexibilities in the TRIPS agreement itself that you can use to make medicines available and that countries often shy away from. So there was a case, for example, in Colombia that we documented when countries want to use those flexibilities to increase access for their population, they are threatened by rich countries like Switzerland with other trade-related sanctions. So they are very careful in actually implementing those flexibilities if they are threatened with other investment sanctions or so on. So there are these solutions also within the system, but there are also really important alternatives that we should continue to discuss like open science or those delinkage models. And they are there. It's just a question of political will.
So I will say it is important to find a midway between maybe foster innovation and protect population and avoid the monopoly in a sense. So this, we're almost done, and this leads us to our final question that is our hallmark in a sense. In your opinion, is the economy stupid?
It's not the economy that is stupid, I would say. It's about power relations and who gets to set the rules in the game. And as we know, historically and from many other societies, there are other models of doing economic transactions. And they exist, and it's a question of power relations, of capital and property, of who actually gets to set the rules in the game.
Very good answer, quite intriguing. I think this question is just so good. Everyone has a different point of view on it, depending on where you work. It's always intriguing, it's so simple. I'm really appreciating the answers we're getting. It was interesting talking to you. Thank you very much, Gabriela. Because we've been used now to talk to experts that are usually linked to economics, I guess more tightly than you are, although any field really is linked to economics. So we're not afraid with this podcast to go new routes. But it's refreshing to get a new point of view on these things. The point I think that was the most surprising is you mentioned that the pharma is kind of a game. It's kind of a game between different actors. And then you caught yourself up by saying million lives are involved. Well, none of us would have caught ourselves up. We all know it, and it's good to be reminded. But in economics, we just forget about it. So it's good to have also a point of view of someone who still sees all the effects that our small game type of game theory decisions actually have in the back, that millions of lives are at stake sometimes, and that this isn't just a game, but it's way more than this, and we shouldn't consider economics as a game. Again, what you taught to us was very frightening, as I would like to remind our listeners, that the pharma is the biggest lobby is definitely something I didn't know, but it's frightening, even though, as you mentioned to us, it is not like the Empire in Star Wars, but it is not a conspiracy, it is real. But thank you for your insights. Maybe for our listeners who aren't familiar, I guess for most of you, of them, with anything related to health, and who were intrigued by what you said today, do you have any place that our listeners could follow you, maybe your activities? Or also, maybe, do you want to promote some work you've already published and that they could go check out after listening to this episode?
Yes, thank you to both of you. It was very interesting to have your questions. Just what just now came to my mind, as economists, you might be interested in the work of Mariana Mazzucato. If you don't know her yet, she works from a very informed economic perspective and in those terms that many of you are perhaps more familiar than I am on health and economics. So that's a very good reference. If you want to read more about our work at Public Eye, it's publiceye.ch. The website is mostly in German and French, but it's also some parts are translated to English. And our report, Big Pharma Takes It All, it's in English. It's about 40 or 50 pages long. So you can kind of browse through those strategies and get the references for all the things that I said and claimed.
Okay, fantastic. Probably in Italy, our listener know Mariana Mazzucato as she was a former part of the former government. He was an economic advisor. So to conclude, thank you again, Gabriela Hertig. I hope I did not mispronounce that. And these were Damian and Gianluca from Rethinking Economics Italia, and I hope we'll see you at the next one. Bye-bye.